Well, great. Thanks so much for coming this morning, and thank you for the warm introduction. It's been really wonderful to be with all of you these days and to learn about the work here at the Borderlands. And so one of the things I wanted to do this morning was to try to make connections to work in Central America and the movements, social movements in both places. So it's wonderful. Teresa came this morning prepared to create an altar, and so did I. So it's the beginning of seeing the links between what's happening in Central America and what's happening here. And so I also thank you, Sarah, for inviting me to be here. It's been wonderful. And as you said, we met at your presentation at SCE. So it's worth going to conferences and gatherings.
And on the last morning.
On the last morning. And in that small room were many people involved and interested in working on issues of borderlands. So it was a really great, although small group, it was the group that I felt like I had come home and found a space in that conference. So, you know, it's really rare that we have these times to come together to discuss these sorts of issues and also the links between the academy and churches, the advocacy and activism. So I really appreciate this opportunity. I'm grateful to be here. As Bahar said, my work over the past 20 years, both pastoral and academic, has focused on women's rights in Latin America. Particularly women's faith-based responses to gender-based murder or feminicide. So this murder is called feminicide because it's supported by political, legal, and ecclesial structures which assure the impunity of perpetrators and sustain a culture of violence towards women. So in the past 5 years or so, I've been interested in how traditional religious practices such as pilgrimage and prayer, lament and ritual have been used in public settings to protest gender violence. And so I've been observing, teaching, and writing about this out of the context of northern Honduras and northern Mexico, particularly Ciudad Juarez. And I should say that I did live in Honduras for 5 years in the 90s, and I've traveled back and forth to Honduras ever since then, and so spend quite a bit of time every year in Honduras. And I'm going in 2 weeks. For about 2 weeks. So I brought students. We were there on a January immersion trip. And so some of what I'll be talking about today, we've presented at a number of venues at Harvard and Union Theological Seminary. So I just want to say, though, in terms of feminicide, today in Honduras post-coup, the framing of feminicide and the demands of women's groups around it has shifted dramatically, so that the campaign against feminicide is understood and asserted in light of a much broader political structural platform. It's much more radical. And let's see. So now what women are saying is ni golpe de Estado, ni golpes contra las mujeres. So it's very different. So they're placing the violence against women in the context of violence at the whole institutional state level. So neither abuse of the state nor abuse of women. And so feminist groups then are pushing for what's called a constitutional assembly to actually rewrite the whole constitution. So it will protect, promote, and respect the rights of the majority of Hondurans. And this is very different, for instance, than what's happening in, or what has happened in Guatemala and Mexico, where feminists are pushing for a new law on feminicide. In Honduras now, people are asking for a whole new constitution. And so links are being made with other issues. And so there's an analysis of the injustice at the structural level, because there's been a collapse in institutional order in Honduras. There's been a change in consciousness then. And as Honduran feminist theologian Carmen Manuela del Cid said in a talk earlier this month at Harvard, she said, the utopias of my people are flooding the streets. So that this dreaming and the visioning of social justice can't be stopped. It's a process that has just overflowed, literally, in the streets in terms of masses of people gathering to express their opinions and exercise their citizenship. And so today I would like to dedicate my talk to one such person, Wendy Avila, who a woman in her 20s who died, was killed in September 2009 because of complications to tear gas. Because as you can imagine, there's been a lot of reaction and repression to the citizen mobilization. And so Wendy was killed with these complications to tear gas. And so today she represents, she's a symbol for many others who've died. She's a symbol of the involvement of women. 60 to 70% of the resistance movement is made up of women, and also of the youth who have really mobilized to resist the militarization of Honduras. And so she represents a new generation and a new moment. And they say here, por ellas no pararemos, or por ella. So for Wendy, we will not stop. So for Wendy and for all of those who are today risking their lives and or have given their lives already, I would like to begin with a moment of silence. Thank you. So today I would like to divide my remarks into two main areas. The first part is, you know, I'll begin by talking a little bit more about the resistance movement and also the conditions in Honduras post-coup in light of U.S. economic and military policy, and also issues of borderlands and migration or immigration policy of the U.S. And secondly, I'll focus on responses to the coup of religious institutions and communities. And I wanted to highlight, since we're talking about lived theologies, to highlight the living faith practices of those like Wendy who've been involved in the movement, which is a movement, it's called the resistance movement, but also the movement for participatory democracy. So the background piece that I distributed gives a brief history of the events leading up to the coup and immediately following. And it was written by Rodolfo Pastor, who was the Minister of Culture under President Zelaya, who was ousted. And Rodolfo Pastor was a visiting professor this fall at Harvard, a professor of history. So it was wonderful to be able to meet with him, and he gave a number of different talks. But I shared this piece because I wanted to help fill in the gaps of the mainstream media here in the States and to highlight U.S. involvement and also this outpouring of citizen mobilization, which we really don't hear that much about here. Now, with the huge resurgence in citizen engagement, Rodolfo Pastor says, paradoxically, the objectives of the Zelaya government of citizen empowerment have been achieved. And this has occurred, he said, you know, it's historic. It's Honduras was always known as a country where the people were so politically indifferent and passive. And there, the whole image has changed now in Latin America. So there's been this new civic consciousness, and he says an irreversible social transformation. So things will never be the same again. So, of course, as I mentioned, there's been a big backlash to this citizen mobilization. And just in the first month after the coup, which was June 28th, today we celebrate 10 months because it's April 28th, so 10 months after the coup. Just in the first month after the coup, feminicides increased by 60%. And that was documented cases. And clearly, many people weren't going to institutions since there had just been a coup. So the legitimacy of institutions had collapsed. And yet, the reported cases increased 60%. And this is in a context where clearly, again, the state is seen and is the perpetrator of these crimes. So the public confidence in the legal and judicial systems has disappeared. And there have been a litany of human rights violations documented by many human rights organizations, including Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, and the Inter-American Commission on Human Rights. And these include the suspension of basic civil and political rights. This was really reinforced after Zelaya returned and remained in the Brazilian embassy in September. That's when the repression really became more intense. So the rights to the assemble, to free speech, and to free movement were suspended. There has been an arbitrary imposition of curfews, attacks, as I mentioned, on nonviolent protesters like Wendy, and not just with tear gas, but also with pepper spray and with bayonets and sexual violence, which has included gang rape by police of women. Also, selective assassinations, at least 40 people have been killed, and over 6,000 illegal detentions. And again, this has all been documented carefully by human rights organizations. So in a word, there's been a criminalization of social protest with the collapse of democratic institutions. And the hope of the people puts terror in the hearts of the elite, says Del Cid. She says the elite arm themselves with weapons in defense against a people armed with utopias. So, the violations of rights after June 28th, when Zelaya was ousted, forced out. You might remember the photos that morning. He was forced out, like at 5 a.m. in his pajamas by hundreds of troops, put on a plane, and brought to Costa Rica. And at that time, President Micheletti took over, who was the president of the Congress. So the de facto President Micheletti took over. And under him, a lot of these human rights violations occurred. And yet it's important to note that even under the new president, who was inaugurated in the end of January, Porfirio Lopo, the violations have continued and, in fact, have increased by some reports. There have been, just in the first 100 days of his, after his inauguration of his presidency, there were 250 documented cases of human rights violations. Honduras as a whole has the highest homicide rate in Central America. It had increased 17% from 2008 to 2009 to be 68 per 100,000, and that's compared to the world average of 8 per 100,000. And just in the first months of 2010, that rate increased even more. So it's important, again, to note that the elections which happened to elect this new president occurred under a coup government, under militarized conditions, and they were not elections recognized by the majority of countries around the world, nor by the United Nations, and yet the U.S. recognized the elections, and the U.S. has continued to really pressure governments throughout Latin America to recognize this government under President Lobo. So the resistance movement has continued, and it has continued also to cross borders. Rodolfo Pastor's, one of his most recent essays, talks about a new movement, which is called Hondurans for Democracy, based in the U.S. So it's made up of Hondurans living in the U.S. as well as others in the U.S. in solidarity with the movement. And it's advocating, like those in Honduras, for refounding the country and rewriting the Constitution based on a constituent assembly. And this movement, then, for a more democratic Honduras has crossed other borders in the Americas. This coup greatly solidified social movements in Latin America, where the coup was seen as a coup against the whole continent. People were outraged. And spontaneously, protests began in other countries. And one of the slogans was, "We are all Honduras." So that people were organizing in the streets. And I should go back. Ni golpe de Estado, ni golpe contra mujeres. Underneath, it's written Feminists in Resistance of Costa Rica against the coup in Honduras. So this is one example of many groups which have become organized throughout the continent who see that there's this new, it's a passion, a pan-Latin American passion, I would say, in identity, which has become solidified. And it's part not just of a public expression, but it's tied to a political platform of participatory democracy throughout the region. Now, in addition to being a movement which is transnational, the movement within Honduras, and I know Honduras best, but I would say within Honduras internally, it is very diverse. So it's a movement made up of groups who have rarely worked together so closely. This is one reason I asked Angel this yesterday, because in Honduras, the GLBT movement is connected now and working with the feminist movement, working with the youth, and union organizers are coming together, Lenca and Garifuna leaders. And so it's an embodiment of this concept of rights as indivisible and interdependent. And they're really working on this at the ground level and with all the tensions that involves. And there's often paradox and contradiction, and yet people call each other on the discriminations and the prejudice they see in the movement. And so they're trying to really work together. And recently there was a big meeting in Esperanza, an indigenous Lenca community in the mountains, where they actually worked on how they would rewrite the Constitution. And there were 1,000 people there from all over Honduras. And I heard that the debates were quite you know, vibrant, and yet this is part of what's so dynamic about what's going on. So it's a real process happening today, dynamic, diverse, and transnational. And I think Honduras, too, is an important case in terms of speaking of the borderlands because it really represents transnational forces, the underlying pushes and pulls of migration that I think are really critical to look at. It underscores that, in fact, that U.S. citizens have crossed the borderlands into Mesoamerica over generations in the form of multinational corporations and military bases out of an interest to defend U.S. national and economic security. So when we discuss individual crossing at the Mexican U.S. border, it's highly critical to place the issue within this wider context so as not to fall in the trap of reducing it to a problem as one individual run criminal crossing the line, criminal quote unquote, to highlight the deep structural causes and conditions for borderland dynamics that transcend national identity and geographic location. For Honduras does not share a physical border with the U.S., and though we've heard through these days, borderlands is not just a geographic term. And U.S. involvement in Honduras is unmistakable, both present and past. As Ansel Dua states, the borderlands are physically present whenever two or more cultures edge against each other and bleed. There's a lot of bleeding. The original banana republic, Honduras, banana industry has been dominated since the late 1800s by United Fruit, or Chiquita, and Standard Fruit, or Dole. In 1984, during the Reagan administration, military aid to Honduras, which at the time was a country not at war and had only 4 million people, mushroomed in the form of $77.4 million as part of an anti-communist policy to eliminate dissidents. So this aid to Honduras supported Contras in Nicaragua, government forces in El Salvador, and the elite battalion 316 Death Squad within Honduras. Now, after the wars in Nicaragua and El Salvador ended, the military training and equipment reappeared in Central America in the hands, among others, of narco traffickers and gang members. And now, under Reagan, also, the spearheading happened of the Caribbean Basin Initiative, which was a private sector project including military assistance of $10 million to Honduras, which fostered the growth beginning in 1987 of the industrial processing zones. So this is what Pedro was talking about, the connections between economic and military policy that we're also seeing here at the borderlands. So these industrial processing zones or free trade zones offer exemptions to U.S. corporations for establishing export assembly plants. And between 1989 and 1998, the number of workers in the maquiladoras or the offshore assembly plants, primarily the garment industry, grew from 8,000 to 100,000 in northern Honduras. And this policy has continued under the CAFTA, the Central America Free Trade Agreement. And what's very interesting to note is that feminicide in Honduras is concentrated in this northern zone where the maquilas are concentrated, like in Juarez, where multinational factories proliferate, which employ mainly young women. And there's also been connections from Guate, Mexico, and Honduras in terms of where the drug cartels are highly concentrated. So there's a link between the feminicides, the drug cartels, and the multinational corporations. And I'm not making any causal connections. I'm making observations here. I mean, there's a lot of work to be done. But it's a really sort of a glaring geography, so to speak, of economics, military, and violence towards women. So the maquilas, as much as they've been praised as a source of job creation and income for Honduras and beyond, I think it's really important to note, as Pilar Aquino eloquently points out in her article, that foreign remittances also make up a majority and more substantial form of national income for many countries. Rodolfo Pastor states that remittances to Honduras of Hondurans in the U.S. is the major source of foreign currency into the country and the best distributed. And Pastor also points out that the movement for participatory democracy is seen by many as a threat to Honduran U.S. immigrant status. So the fear is that it could result in a change in U.S. immigration policy toward Honduras, with Hondurans being blocked entry into the U.S. or being deported. So clearly, U.S. immigration policy is seen as a form of punishment, reward, and control of the affairs of Central America. Now, the connections between U.S. economic, military, and immigration policy perhaps are very obvious to us here. But I really feel that the majority of members of our nation and churches really don't have much of an idea. And I think it's a really critical area for theoethical education in our academic and pastoral communities. It's really amazing to me sometimes to realize that, you know, highly educated, whether formally or informally, people of the churches or of our university communities really have very little idea of U.S. involvement in Mexico, Central, and South America, the history of the southern U.S., and meaning Texas and all the history that we've been hearing about. You know, and people become infuriated when someone would cross into the U.S., labeling them criminals when they themselves have crossed many borders of the Americas by way of belonging to a country deeply complicit in the destabilization of the region through a strategic plan of military and economic intervention. So this is a really important point as we move forward to ministering to our church congregations here in the U.S. and beyond. You know, in the U.S., as U.S. churches and communities, let's look at our side of the street. Who crossed what border when? Who is the stranger in a strange land? And who is the alien and unwanted visitor? Who is the uninvited guest? And I look forward to talking to you all, and we have small groups after this, to try to think about how to deal with some of these issues and how to raise them in our communities. So just most immediately now, you know, to help to explore some of this, I want to look at the religious actors and theological expressions in Honduras, because I think that this can give us some clues to how we might proceed. Not all of the examples, I think, are examples that we might follow, but because first I want to talk about the formal religious institutions. The official leadership of both the Catholic Church and the evangelical churches have publicly supported the coup. The very well-loved Catholic Cardinal Oscar Rodriguez, a former papal candidate and advocate for the poor, has plummeted in image and popularity. In his very palatial home, which is now surrounded by the military in Tegucigalpa, the walls are covered with graffiti, which say Cardemal, or evil cardinal. He spoke on the weekend of July 4th, 5th, when Zelaya was coming back, urging Zelaya not to come back and saying there'd be a bloodbath if he returned. And he has not publicly denies that there's been a coup, saying that it was never a coup. So he publicly has supported the coup and has urged all of the Catholic leadership in Honduras not to speak about the political situation. So, pro-coup marches before and after June 28th were filled with conservative Christians wearing white shirts as signs of peace and carrying signs that said, "Thank you, armed forces, for protecting Honduras." They also often carried signs of the Virgin Mary. In Honduras, Mary, Our Lady of Suyapa, is the protectress of the armed forces. And many of the signs were made in the maquilas, the U.S. assembly plants, and they were written in English, perfectly written in English, whereas the signs of the resistance movement were, you know, written in Spanish, clearly, and by hand. So also the military supported the marches that were pro-coup, and they were very orderly. Often maquila workers were coerced into participating. They were brought in busloads from the maquilas during the workday and as an obligation of employment. So there's been a convergence of the top ecclesial, military, and economic forces in support of the rupture of constitutional order in Honduras to establish a military state which promotes a neoliberal economic model of development and benefits an elite sector. And again, all of this in the name of a Christian God. So the forces which create and sustain the coup in Honduras represent a transnational conservative leadership across the Americas. Just as I spoke of the movement of solidarity for a participatory democracy being transnational, also this movement for the destabilization of the government is transnational. There is indeed strong evidence to show that the coup was the result of long-term strategic geopolitical planning of a transnational right, including the elite not just of Central America, but of Venezuela, Colombia, Cuba, and the U.S. After the strong reaction of outrage around the world by multilateral bodies and governments, Honduran businessmen immediately turned to U.S. lobbyists, including the former lawyer of the Clintons, to argue their case in Washington. And congressional members like Connie Mack then spearheaded a congressional resolution in favor of the coup. So political, ecclesial, business, and military leaders justify the ousting of Zelaya with quasi-legal arguments, calling it a constitutional secession. And they view it as a kind of pilot project, which could be replicated in other parts of Latin America. And due to such pressures, the U.S. still has not called the coup in Honduras. The U.S. has called it a coup, but not a military coup. And indeed, U.S. military council involvement in the coup is unmistakable. The U.S. has its largest military base in Central America in Honduras at Palmarola, which was the site of training of the armed forces in the 80s for the destabilization of Nicaragua and against the FMLN in El Salvador. Palmarola was the destination of the plane of Zelaya when he was ousted on June 28th, went first to Palmarola and then to Costa Rica. And Honduran military leaders like Vazquez Velazquez, who's the head of the armed forces, were trained at the School of the Americas in Georgia, the then called School of the Americas. And the coup has ushered in the return of clandestine prisons and death squads. The security advisor under de facto President Micheletti was Billy Hoya, who was the author of the death squads in the 1980s. Just this month, U.S. Ambassador to Honduras Hugo Lorenz celebrated with President Lobo the opening of a new American naval base in La Mosquitia, which is the poorest region of Honduras. And Lorenz justified it as part of the war on drugs. And important to note that Lorenz was an appointee of Bush. He remained under the Obama administration. He was an advisor on the Andean region to President Bush during the attempted coup of 2002 in Venezuela, which was publicly named by Bush as Bush publicly named his involvement in that coup, the attempted coup. And also, Otto Rech, who's an ultra-conservative politician, was in the country just this month meeting with the conservative sector of elite businesses and leaders. Now, to understand the position, conservatives worry about the growing trend of progressive governments in Latin America who increasingly advocate for the rights of the poor and indigenous, such as Bolivia, Venezuela, and Ecuador, who belong to the ALBA, which you may have heard of, the Alternative Free Trade Agreement of the Americas, a symbol of the demand of the South for economic self-sufficiency. And Zelaya's alliance with such governments sent a warning signal to the wealthy, who declared he was trying to establish a popular authoritarianism like Chavez, called a 21st century communism. And under Zelaya, Honduras did join ALBA, and that was with the affirmation of the whole government. I mean, the government under Zelaya approved that. And yet there was great fear as Zelaya remained in power, particularly after he raised the minimum wage by 60%. And so what the Honduran elite asserted they were trying to avoid, and there's a really, really deep fear and hate of Chavez and deep hatred. That what they were trying to avoid, a militarized authoritarian government, they have in fact created. You know, in trying to save democracy from 21st century communism, they've really destroyed the official roots of democracy in the country. Institutional structures have collapsed and the legitimacy of official agencies destroyed. So Honduras shifted from civilian rule, from military to civilian rule in 81. And there's a great sense of mourning because so much of what had been built up by many organizations over these decades has now been destroyed with the collapse of the break in the constitutional order and the collapse of institutional structures. So really what I think that we need to do is to build upon and strengthen these transnational forces for participatory democracy, for justice and peace across the Americas, that's founded in a new prophetic religious leadership and in a renewed sense of theological creativity and risk. And leaders in Honduras can be our guides here. And this is how I wanted to end, to just point out the courage and the imagination of the leaders on the ground in Honduras in the midst of the militarized repression. And it really is a life and death struggle. Many people I know have received death threats. And what the strategy is now is really to target leaders at the grassroots level who don't have a high profile in small communities. And it's amazing to me, places I've gone for years, that people have received death threats. It's really intense. So I think that we really need to reformulate our faith commitments at this time and challenge ourselves at this historical moment as we see our brothers and sisters in Central America and Latin America doing. So I would just like to cite the theological creativity of some of those involved in the resistance who've used the arts, ritual, public prayer, and preaching And, you know, this is similar to what I described in the beginning. The movement against feminicide has also used these kinds of new expressions of traditional religious practices in public to protest injustice. Now, I'll just give three examples. The first is Radio Progreso, and I have up here, Yo Escucho Radio Progreso. It's a ministry of the Jesuits in northern Honduras, which began immediately to serve as the voice of the people after the coup at a time when many radio stations were being shut down, hooded, armed men were storming alternative radio stations and sabotaging, pouring chemicals on the equipment and destroying the these radio stations. Also, it's just been a real environment of repression, and that happened in Honduras right after the coup. Not that kind of, the military invaded the radio station, didn't destroy the equipment, but right after that, the community took the radio station back, demanded that the military release it back to them. So the radio station has continued. They have a daily mass in the morning. And this is amazing because the Catholic Church has told all Catholic leaders not to speak about it. And Radio Progreso provides a forum for campesinos, for all of the leadership, anyone to call in and express their opinion. And so many really listen day to day. And also, it has it's part of a popular radio network throughout Latin America. So people are able to listen throughout the continent and also in the U.S. And you can go onto it on the internet. So I think because of these international connections through the Jesuit network, through the radio popular radio networks, it has not been shut down. It's continued to operate. And yet, the priest who's in charge, Padre Ismael Moreno, Padre Melo, has received a lot of death threats, and they've increased recently. And he literally now has gone into hiding. He's been doing a lot of speaking in the U.S. But also, I've heard now, the local reporters are getting death threats. So they get them on the cell phones, text messages. So they've had to change their phone numbers. And other people I know who work, just, you know, leaders in the grassroots communities who've worked for years providing for the needs of the poor now are getting death threats on the cell phone. So another example, moving on then, another example is a group called Forum of Women for Life. And it's made up of a coalition of women's groups who've been involved, for instance, in human rights monitoring in the maquilas, economic empowerment of women. Like we have a conference today on microcredit. They give small loans. Also human rights training, like Pedro talked about, this kind of thing going on in the communities in Honduras. So women involved with that formed a group called Forum of Women for Life in 2002. And it was a response to the U.S. invasion of Iraq. They gathered in the central square in front of the cathedral to protest and to stand in solidarity with the women of Iraq. And out of that, they began to address the violence against women in their own setting and began to demand justice in the face of feminicide, which was really increasing from 2002 forward. And that's when the connections began to be made with Guatemala and Juarez as well, these kinds of looking at more structural causes. But let me just say that at that time, the women began to meet on the 15th of every month. They would carry the pictures of women who had been recently killed and name them, have public prayers, and it was beautiful. And I went with some students. I brought students from Union Theological Seminary at the time, and we were shocked, actually, when we got there because we expected a very heavy atmosphere, but they were playing Gracias a la Vida. There was much art and the families of women who had been killed. So it was kind of celebration of life. Well, at the same time, it was a lament. Now, this same group with the coup has taken that kind of creativity into the streets, and they're now real seen as spiritual leaders who bring another dimension into the march. They bring prayer, ritual, silence, and some, I'll show you. This is what they were doing before the coup. So you see an example of they would write the names of women on crosses and they did this on the cathedral steps and in the street. And again, it takes great courage to do this in the setting. But even more so now, when the right to assemble has been suspended and the right to free expression, women are taking to the street, Mujeres en Resistencia. They've joined a group made up of a broader coalition of feminist groups. And this is one march of many. And they carry a banner that say Mujeres en Resistencia in the attack of the butterflies. Butterflies attacking the military. So the butterfly has become a symbol of transformation. And also there, it's a pilgrimage, like a traditional religious practice of pilgrimage in the street. They're mourning those who've died. And we asked them about it. Some of the students I brought said, well, tell us about the performance. And the woman couldn't understand. We were trying to translate. She said, I don't know what you're saying. And they said, performance. She finally said, listen, this is not a performance. She said, this is my reality. And so, and she started to cry, you know, this is, we're mourning the deaths. Often they come from funerals. They come to the street. She said, this is my reality. This is not a performance. So it's part, I think, of a personal as well as social healing. There's much anger and trauma that people are living through. And so it's part of that, the church as the place where that healing can happen. And at the same time, it's a political statement. This is one ritual they did. This is Patti, who dressed as Democracia, which is the name of women's name in a way. So it stands for ni golpe de Estado, ni golpe contra las mujeres, neither abuse of women nor abuse of the state. This is democracy being crucified, being killed in Honduras. And she's a woman also being killed. Now, students made this slide for me, Karen Bray. And she made it for herself, actually, in her presentation. I'm borrowing it from her. The pictures come from the women themselves. That's important to say. So these are their self-portraits in many ways. They take the pictures. But she says crucifixion of democracy. And I would say, too, it's resurrection at that moment because women are daring to go to the street to express themselves right then, right there. And they're doing it in front of La Prensa, which is one of the pro-coup presses. And when this happened, women all dressed as La Llorona, the wailing woman, to wail, to speak out. So this is resurrection, finding the voice. But they said this was so important for them. And at the time, La Prensa closed down and all the employees left. The women were, it was nonviolent, but people were afraid. So this is Patti as the crucifixion of democracy. And just to say then again that this group of women in the North Coast have been asked by women in Tegucigalpa to come down and share these strategies, to share the spiritual dimension because many people are suffering very much now with a lot of fear. And they're looking for ways to work together and to be able to move forward under what's increasingly a difficult context. And just to say that part of this searching has involved going back to find the traditional roots of religion, including the indigenous and the Garifuna or African religious tradition. And one woman we spoke to, Jessica Sanchez, said when she was held by the police, her brother was attacked by the police and his hands were broken. That was one strategy they were using, breaking the hands, breaking the feet, saying, now march. And her brother's hands were broken, and she went to find him in the hospital. And the public hospital was releasing people who had been in the marches. They said, you come in here and you'll go back out worse. So she went in and she demanded they not release him. And the police came up to her and she said, you know, I'm a human rights advocate, I'm a feminist in resistance, and I'm a daughter of Oshala. Her practice is Yoruba. And so that also has been a great source of strength for many women. And the Garifuna community has been very involved in the resistance. This is a calendar that's made, and this is a woman who's part of the Lenca community, part of the resistance. So just to say that, the movement for rights is part of the rights of the indigenous community, which includes embracing what has been a demonized religion. And embracing the religion and making it not just through advocacy, but through these public, visible prayer and rituals. So just to close with a third example of Christians in resistance that's formed. So like many other spontaneous movements which have arisen, Christians who've never worked together have come together in public prayer and preaching. And what this Christians in Resistance is made up of Anglican, Mennonite, Evangelical, and Catholic members, some from the Forum of Women for Life. And I must say the Mercy Sisters are very involved. Dominicans have also publicly spoken at the level of Central America against the coup because they weren't able to speak at the national level. But congregations, Catholic congregations, have turned to their international leadership to speak. And there have been some very brave people, and they continue to be very brave. So one of the strategies of Christians in Resistance was to they, on their text, on the cell phones, they began to send each other text messages of biblical texts that could help them in this time of repression. And then they decided that each group would take one prophet, say Paul or Isaiah, come with a reading that spoke to this historic moment and preach it publicly in the square. So they did this, and they said that it was amazing. They said that the prophetic message of the biblical text was so clear, and they never understood it in the same way. This call to justice, this call to stand in the face of injustice. So they felt this connection then to the prophets, and that this is really what the religion is about. So just to summarize then, these traditional religious practices of prayer, of preaching, of pilgrimage, ritual, have taken on new and vibrant forms in post-coup Honduras. And they're really what I think of as transgressive spiritual practices or trans-spiritualities, crossing boundaries of traditional separations between public and private, secular and sacred, profane and inspired. They reflect transsacramentos. This is a term used by the Familia Galán in Bolivia, which is a group who advocates for the rights of the GLBT community. Talk about transsacramentos. And I see here in the borderlands these transsacramentos at the Eucharist, sharing the Eucharist across a fence, gathering at Easter time. Amazing. To interrupt and challenge laws which do not serve life but destroy in the name of justice, which protect privilege instead of persons. So behind these trans-spiritual practices lies a transgressive theologies, which disrupt transnational structures of power and build transnational bonds of solidarity, slowly creating another world of justice and harmony. Just one more image from a group in Juarez I visited. They call themselves Las Hormigas because they said it's a work that you don't see, perhaps. It's an underground work. We're working slowly. It seems like it's not important, imperceptible, but we're doing really important work that's transformative and will bring about radical change. So underlying then these practices is this resurgence of certain concepts of liberation theology, which had been sort of lost after the 80s in many ways. People say the youth had nothing to live for anymore in Honduras. But now there's this vision of utopia, that people are armed with the utopian visions. And the Christians see this in many ways as reflecting the reign of God. It's an eschatological theology, the coming of the reign of God, a reign which is both present and not yet. So the Christian actors in the resistance in Honduras are strongly fueled and fed by this theological certainty. Not just it's a deep heart certainty. So I have the heart that the work they are doing is God's work of justice. It's the only work to be done now in our lives. We're called to this. And I really think we're called to this, and that's why we're here, to support each other, to support these each other as a transnational community of faith. People risking their lives every day to usher in this new era of very real social and spiritual peace and equity, so that together we can realize the utopian vision, the reign of God. And I just want to end with the words of Jessica Sanchez, who I mentioned previously, a human rights advocate, who spoke at Union Theological Seminary last month. And she talked about the fact that it certainly is a life and death struggle, that she said there's a lot of death in Honduras now, violence, fear, and she said too much silence. And she urged us to embrace spiritual practices that not necessarily involve silence, because silence was so used in such a destructive way. And so she asked us to have a moment of applause. And that's how I would like to end. We began with silence, but can we end with applause in the name of Jessica, in the name of Wendy, in the name of all Cardman Mabelda Cid, all of those, the Forum of Women for Life, Christians in Resistance, those at the borderlands. We've combined our altars here, those who are struggling. We've listened to all week or all these last 2 days, Pedro, all of those who are working so hard to create the reign of God, to bring about democracy, which is indeed participatory, that honors the lives and dignity of all. So in celebration of their work and as a call to justice for ourselves and to all who can hear, let us break silence together.